This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can now watch our TV show on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. When you open your newspaper, there's content that's clearly written and edited by journalists next to ads that are identified as such. On TV, there are shows interrupted by content that's clearly advertising. We've gotten really good, however, at avoiding these ads through DVRs and simply through desensitizing our brains to them. But now, in the new and unregulated world of the internet, ads are increasingly becoming less visible, and companies are blurring the lines between content and advertising so much so that corporations looking to sell products are simply creating their own content. And if that content is compelling enough, we consume it, we share it, we may or may not buy products based on our exposure to it. But what does all of that mean when most or all of the content that we consume is controlled by corporate advertisers? My guest is Mara Einstein. She's a professor of media studies at Queens College at the City University of New York. She's an independent marketing consultant. She's been working in or writing about media and marketing for more than 25 years and has been an executive at NBC, MTV Networks, and at major advertising agencies. Dr. Einstein is the author of a number of books, including Compassion, Inc., which examines the growing trend of promoting consumer products as a means to fund social causes and effective social change. Her latest book is called Black Ops Advertising, Native Ads, Content Marketing, and the Covert World of the Digital Cell. Welcome to the program, Mara.
Thank you so much.
So you come from inside this field, which is pretty interesting. First, how different is the internet today from traditional media, internet content from newspapers, traditional paper newspapers or network television? The world of the internet is just such an exploding world that there's new outlets and outfits every single day, and it's not clear anymore what's a producer of news and what's simply a producer of content.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a couple of things going on in terms of being able to parse what you were just asking me about. On the one hand, what we've had is a lot of so-called legacy media, things like traditional television networks and newspapers like the New York Times, transferring into the digital space. And so they've had a difficult time trying to figure out what their new revenue model is going to be. When you had a newspaper like the New York Times, page in the New York Times might be $75,000 to have a page in that newspaper. You transfer that into the online space, people have been getting their content for free. The advertising is also significantly less expensive. And so media outlets like that are trying to figure out ways to support the content they produce. In order to be able to do that, something like the New York Times produces what's known as native advertising. And what native advertising is, are articles that look exactly like any other article that would appear in the New York Times, except that it has an advertiser behind it. And there's very little indication as to the fact that there is an advertiser behind it. But the same is also true for what we think of as companies that started in the online space. So something like BuzzFeed, right? A lot of people look at BuzzFeed, and people are probably mostly used to the listicles, right? The list of, you know, how have things changed over the last 20 years, or which Fraggle Rock character are you, and those sorts of things. Well, some of those are ads, and some of those aren't. And just the fact that some are and some aren't lead us to start to question, you know, when are we engaging with content that has an advertiser behind it? The problem becomes, if we don't know there's an advertiser behind it, we attend to it or read it differently than we do if there is an advertiser behind it. So right. If we know we're looking at an ad, we go, oh, well, this somebody has a vested interest in me thinking about this in a certain way. It's very different if you're looking at an article in the New York Times and reading it for the information and assuming that the information is unbiased.
So today we basically have companies like BuzzFeed, very different from companies like the New York Times, but how do we consume content created by these two different entities, both of which are trying to engage in revenue sales through and revenue garnering through ad sales? Is BuzzFeed a news site?
Well, they like to think of themselves as a news site. That's a really good question. And actually, recently, they just divided themselves up so that news is one area and video is another area. That's a whole nother conversation. But they really are trying to move more and more into the hard news space. But the issue with something like a BuzzFeed or Vice or any sort of content like that is that we don't primarily go to the website BuzzFeed to read the content. The way we get the content is through social media. And so if you were to send me something, I would pay attention to it a little bit more and say, oh, you know, someone I know sent this content to me, so I'm going to give it a little bit more attention. If BuzzFeed just sent it to me, I don't know that I would give it the same kind of attention. The other thing is that because most of this advertising content is sent through social media, there's certain things that are done to get us to want to send the content forward to our friends. So things that particularly evoke tremendous amount of emotion in us are going to be the things that we're most likely to share. So either things that generate a lot of awe or generate a lot of anger are going to be the things that we'll pass forward. Or if they're really funny, we want to share those things with our friends.
And therein comes the idea of the clickbait headline. And, you know, this has been around for a few years now. Upworthy was one of those outfits that really pushed this this kind of very seductive headline that is designed to make you click that all-important click to go into the page that then exposes you to dozens of pop-up ads or ads on the side, or maybe no ads at all and just the article itself is sponsored content. Tell us about the clickbait headline and the fact that it's really even just a formula how you write these.
Right. Well, it's really interesting. One of the journalists I spoke with actually called it whore bait. Which because they feel like they've gotten to the point, even traditional journalists feel like they've gotten to the point where they've had to pander in order to get people to read the content that they're producing. But there are ways to pull people in to want to read this kind of content. And the problem is some of those may be legitimate news stories, but a headline writer has created them in such a way to make it so that people will enter into the space. But some of them are ads that people don't know about. And the listicles are great examples of that, because you might read a listicle and it won't have anything in there. And it's not till you get to the eighth or ninth or tenth thing on the list that you find out that that's where the advertiser content is. And by that point, you've already invested several minutes worth of time with the content. That's what also makes this so sort of insidious, particularly for consumers, is that it's not until you've invested a good sense of time that you find out that you've been engaging with this this advertising content.
Mara, I've decided to rename the top title of our interview today. You'll never guess how far advertisers are going to make a buck. What we learned will shock you. And then we're going to do our own little experiment just to see how many people would click on that link and share it. But I mean, so who exactly is creating these things? You know, what's the content? I about a year ago, for various reasons, I started looking through journalism jobs and to see what was out there. And today, increasingly, first of all, there's almost no jobs there for journalists to do actual journalism. That's very, very difficult to find. But now, really, a lot of companies like BuzzFeed, Upworthy, Thrillist, etc., are looking to hire journalists to do marketing work, to write content like they would write a journalistic article, but with the goal of getting people to click to be exposed to the ads. Is this blurring dangerous?
Yes. Yes, and it's actually happening more and more, and even far more now than when I finished writing the book, which is only like several months ago, is now more and more companies are coming out and saying, we're having our editorial staff write the advertising.
Wow.
And really,
wow.
Even a year ago, companies were very conscious of what we used to call the separation of church and state, right? Within journalism, it never was the editorial and the advertising side of the business were supposed to meet. They would fight tooth and nail to make sure the advertisers didn't have any kind of access to what was the editorial content. But that's not true anymore. And one of the first companies that started to do that was Condé Nast, as they just said, yeah, sure, our editorial staff is working with the advertisers. And one of the arguments that they would make was something like, well, people read Vogue for the advertisements as much as they read Vogue for the content. But, you know, that's Vogue. That's not the New York Times. So a company like the New York Times is very conscious of having a separation between the two. But the truth of the matter is the people that are in the what they call T brand, which is their studio that creates native advertising, are people who have come out of traditional journalism. The difference, of course, is that if you were writing a story for a newspaper in a traditional journalistic setting, part of your job is to find out the other side of the story. Yes, you present a story, but also you want to find the other side of the story, and so you have a more rounded picture of what's going on. But if you're writing a story and you know that an advertiser is paying for it, you aren't going to go out to find somebody who's going to disagree with the advertiser. Mm-hmm. And at the same point, because these people have been trained as journalists, their writing style is very similar to what appears as the editorial part of the content of that particular site.
Which is, of course, the important thing, because then when people read it, they don't realize that they're reading an ad, and that's what's important. Now, what about the fact that advertisers are actually going out of their way to be, this is kind of, not really obvious, but they're going out of their way to be less visible, that they're making their branding and logos less and less overt because they know people switch their brains when they think they're being advertised to. And you open your book telling us a story about Felix Baumgartner, the Austrian man who basically did this, big, huge stunt that seemed on the surface to just be like a, something one would do to get into the Guinness Book of World Records, but turned out to was sponsored, the whole thing sponsored by Red Bull. How does this story tell us that, this idea of advertisers are actually not wanting to be out front and center?
Well, there's two parts to that. One, in terms of what Red Bull does, that's native advertising. And so the native advertising part of the equation is that you try to be as indigenous as possible to the area within which the advertising content exists. And this is actually part of the reason why I wrote the book. If you know how to look for native advertising, you actually do begin to see the sponsored content. And so when I've gone to various universities and shown the video for the Red Bull, initially people don't see the branding in there. But if you draw their attention to it, all of a sudden you do see there's Red Bull on the pod and there's Red Bull on people's t-shirts and so on. And you begin to see where the branding takes place. Now, from an advertising scholar perspective, I can say to you, just because we're not conscious of seeing those logos doesn't mean the existence of those logos don't have an impact on us. And in fact, they do. The other side of this equation is what's known as content marketing. And what content marketing is content that is created by the advertiser that lives on their own website, but then is passed from consumer to consumer through social media. And this has only become more popular, in the last couple of years as social media has taken off, because advertisers could create their own website for years. But the problem was they couldn't get anybody to come to it because nobody would ever bother to go, to the IBM website was not something that people were going to go run and content
right.
from. It's not a whole lot of interesting stuff going on there.
Right. So the important thing is to get it to be shared. How do companies make money? If I see, and you point out even things like, Jimmy Fallon or John Oliver rant, if I see it and it's good and I share it with my friends, how do these companies make money off of shares, of people sharing peer-to-peer on social media? I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean those people doing the sharing are going out and buying the products directly, right?
Not necessarily, but if I'm say Android, if I have an Android phone, I could put an ad on to television and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to put that in a primetime program. Or they had that very cute video that almost everybody shared of the animals holding hands from with the song from Robin Hood. So people thought it was really cute. It was, a dog and a cat and a gorilla and a sheep and whatever it was. And everybody shared that video. And so they got the same kind of exposure to consumers through social media, but at a fraction of the cost. And so that's how they're ultimately able to make money as far as that goes.
And
But in
you
terms
point
of
out
supply.
Chipotle's story as well, Chipotle's scarecrow video and that was shared because it was a well-done story. I mean, it was like watching basically a mini animated film, but it was an ad for Chipotle.
That's one example. The other one that comes to mind right away, too, is something that BuzzFeed did with Friskies. There's a video called Dear Kitten, which is adorable, and it's about an older kitten cat in the house teaching the new kitten all the ins and outs of the household. And it was so successful, they created many different ones of it. But the first one, I just looked the other day, just on YouTube, they've had almost 30 million
Oh
views
my
of this video.
goodness.
So this doesn't include, sending through Facebook or Twitter and all of these other things. So just on YouTube, 30 million views. And bear in mind that that's almost a 3-minute video. So think about this. Normally, people spend 30 seconds with a commercial. They may see it once, right? And here you see it, and now with the primetime television, they don't have the kind of ratings that they used to have. So maybe there's 1 million or 2 million people seeing your ad and spending 30 seconds versus 30 million people spending 3 minutes with your content. I mean, it's a completely,
So
it completely changes the revenue model.
it seems as though basically these days, companies looking to get traction for their advertising, the formula would be to create some kind of event that can generate buzz or some kind of either event that they film or to actually create from scratch something, that it resembles a short feature film or a short animated film enough to provoke some kind of serious emotion in us, whether it's joy or sadness or whatever, and to just get that out there and make it go viral. The idea of something going viral was usually a very organic thing that people, ordinary people did, somebody putting on a mask in their car and laughing about it, or a girl seeing a cute guy at Target and tweeting it and then it being shared. So now that viral phenomenon is something that companies are kind of artificially creating. But is there a blurring of the line between the sort of natural viral phenomenon and the artificial viral phenomenon?
Well, some of that has to do with this idea of influencers, and influencers are people who usually have fo large followings on social media, and then they are used to then send information out to the people who follow them, and then hopefully that gets passed on further and further and further. So the great example of this is the Kardashians, right? And there was the front page story in the New York Times just a couple of weeks ago about how they're paid to put something on Instagram or Twitter, $75,000 for a picture on Instagram. Well, if you have a couple of million followers, and that's somebody who certainly young girls look up to, that's a great way for you to be able to get that content to be sent out and to go viral. But the video is even more important here because, we're talking about this sort of on the online space, and really everything's moving to mobile, and people are looking at content on the go, and so people want to look at video quickly, not really have to think about it. They're on an elevator, they want to just see a little something, interact with it, and go. Or they want to look at a video when they're having lunch at their desk and then share something funny with their friends and so on. And it's going to be that kind of lightweight or anger-inducing content that is going to be the stuff that goes viral. I mean, you could tie it into the current political issues that are going on right now. Donald Trump tapping into fear is absolutely part of this whole issue of inciting people to want to share content. And the more he can drum up the anger, the more likely he is to be able to push this content, further along through the pipeline.
Well, that's a really great point. My guest is Mara Einstein, professor of media studies at Queens College at the City University of New York. We're talking about her new book, Black Ops Advertising, Native Ads, Content Marketing, and the Covert World of the Digital Cell. We're going to keep Mara on for an extended version of this interview, which you can get in the on-demand section of our website. And I'll just come out and say it. It's basically a subscription-based section of our website that helps us generate some funds to create news rather than advertising. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/ruwithsonali. Well, Mara, that brings me to the question then, how do people like me, how do independent journalists, how do people who are really interested in creating objective content that aren't interested in anything other than having the sustainable funding to just keep going, how do we compete in this world that's now saturated with Upworthys and BuzzFeeds and Android and other companies that are creating all this content and making things go viral? I could only dream of having 100,000 followers on Facebook or whatever, right? Or even visiting or sharing my short videos.
Right. Well, you're not the only one trying to figure this out. And a lot of the big media companies are trying to figure this out right now, too, because, I mean, look at the Emmys last night, right? Mm. Here you had the big winners were Game of Thrones and Veep and John Oliver and Transparent. All of these are subscription-based television shows or appear on subscription-based models. They're not on advertiser-supported media vehicles anymore. And so what's happening is that we've taught people to hate advertising so much that we do everything we can to avoid advertising. So what I've been talking about lately is the fact that advertisers have been very, very loud and on the one hand, and consumers got so angry about it that they tried to avoid it. So now advertisers want to be really soft. But they're finding out really quickly that that's not working. And the reason why it's not working is twofold, and one of which you brought up earlier, which is advertisers are starting to realize if consumers don't know that they're behind the content, then it's not really doing a whole lot for their brand on the one hand. Because if you don't know that Nike is supporting a running app or whatever it is, then it's not really helping.
Yeah,
Nike
if you're so invisible that you're invisible, then you are just invisible. So
you're invisible, yeah. Then what do you do? The other issue and what the online space has been trying to say is that targeting people as individuals is the most effective way to sell to them, because you're getting people further along the sales funnel, right? So you're getting somebody right when they're at the point of purchase. They already have the shoes in the cart. They're ready to buy. They don't buy the shoes. And so then you follow, you send that pair of shoes around the web, following them until they buy the shoes ultimately, right?
And this doesn't always work. For example, you might buy the pair of shoes, but that same pair of shoes then still follows you and you're like, I've already bought this. Or you were, or somebody else was using a computer, or you decided you really didn't want to buy these shoes, and then the more you see them, the less you want to buy them.
Right, exactly. And so this idea of retargeting isn't as successful as people thought it was going to be. Hmm. And the other part of it is that advertising isn't just about making that final retail sale. It's also about creating cultural experiences. And so now people are trying to find ways to get back to television. But the problem is the advertising model isn't quite there. And so that's the interesting conversation that's sort of going on right now. So for you, and in terms of your model, I don't know that adding advertising is really the way to go. I think the subscription model is on the online space is going to be where things are going to be. I think advertising online is going to exist for the big guys like the Googles of the world and the Facebooks of the world. But I think for smaller independent producers, it's going to end up being a lot subscription model.
Now, Mara, how does our propensity for becoming more and more addicted to social media and to our smartphones, how does that play into this whole story? Because you point out in your book, we are increasingly so addicted to these devices that we're constantly, you know, multiple dozens of times an hour checking our phones, checking our computer, checking our social media feeds. And this starts at a younger and younger age. You know, we give our children iPads. Schools require digital screens and devices as learning tools, no matter how ineffective they might be. Isn't this sort of an important part of what advertisers rely on?
Yeah, this is one of the other issues that advertisers have sold to consumers, is this idea of that we are willing to give up our information in order to have the free discounts or, whatever it is, the promotional codes in order to be able to grab this information.
Like the loyalty cards at grocery stores.
Right, all of that sort of thing. Okay. But there was research that was done last year by Joe Toro and some of his colleagues out of Penn called the trade-off fallacy. And your listeners, viewers can get it online. It's available online. And it talks about how people don't know that they're being tracked in the way that they're being tracked. And in fact, they're not willing to give up those trade-offs in order to have the information. And they don't want to be tracked in the same way. That's what some of the issues with the ad blockers is all about. And this is also incredibly interesting. And this is what I mean. The industry is so in flux right now. It's so confused that what a lot of people have done is put ad blockers on their phones and on their computers in order not to be tracked, in order not to have advertising come up onto their screen.
Right, they delete the cookies and stuff on our browsers, right, which is quite easy to do.
Right, exactly. But what's happening now is Adblocker Plus, which is one of the leading companies to do that, has just announced that they're going to sell advertising.
What?
Exactly. Like how
that their own blockers are probably not going to block?
Right, exactly. Oh, they're going to decide what advertising they think is acceptable for you to be able to see.
Okay.
That's crazy. That's just crazy. And so what they're saying is, oh, well, we named ad blockers for branding purposes, but in fact, we're improving your internet experience or some nonsense is what they're saying. So, in terms of the tracking, yes, one of the ways to avoid it, ad blockers certainly, Disconnect is one, Adblocker Plus, Ghosterly is another that I use. Also cleaning out your cache so that you don't have that retargeting going on all the time, but also just simply taking vacations from Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and LinkedIn and all those other different spaces, because you do get locked in. And I think that with anything, if you take the time away from it, it is an addiction, and they've been created to be addictive. And so if you take that time away from these technologies, you will find that it becomes easier not to spend the time. And more and more people are taking what they call Facebook vacations.
Right. And also maybe even more sort of literacy, like learning how to spot the advertising, learning how to spot the sponsored content. You know, view all the Grumpy Cat videos you want, but you don't have to share them. you don't have to play into it. Finally, Mara, I want to ask you a personal question. You come out of this world. You're an independent marketing consultant. You've been working in and writing about media and marketing for decades. What has made you be so critical of this? Because, you know, I'm sure there's many people among my viewers who work in the field of marketing, or who've had to work in marketing, you know, maybe journalist friends who are now writing listicles because that's the only way they could make money. And so what has made you critical of this?
Right. Well, it's interesting. I'm one of the crazy people who have an MBA and a PhD. And I actually cut my salary by 2/3 to go into teaching.
Wow.
And yeah, because I felt it was that important. Hmm. And one of the things that happened is my students always ask me, well, you had this great job and you're working at NBC and all of this, and why would you leave? And I honestly say, when I got to the point where I didn't care whether or not Jerry Seinfeld showed up or not, I knew it was time to get out of the business. And so what got me really concerned about it was that my job at that point was to get people to watch more television. And I really didn't feel like that was the best use of my energy on the planet, really, quite honestly. And so as I began to think about it more and go back to school and get my degree, I started poking into areas where I was concerned. Initially, my studies had me looking at marketing of different cultural institutions. And so I was looking at how does marketing change the way we think about religion? Which then took me on to thinking about cause marketing. And what I find is my take, because of my background, is never to attack the industry, but rather to try to find ways to help business people do it better. And so I think because of my background, my experience, I have the credibility that some other academics don't. And so I think that people are willing to talk to me because they understand that I want to help them do their job better. And I think right now, just as with your friends and colleagues that may be working, that were journalists and having to do this, I'm trying to think about, because they don't have time, what this new advertising model is going to look like. Because when you're caught in the minutiae of answering to client whims, you don't have time to think about, okay, how do we make sure that the advertising model doesn't completely implode so that we still have really good television on the air without everybody having to pay for it out of their own pockets?
I mean, you know, there are models such as the BBC in the UK and this idea that, you know, tax dollars can be spent to fund an entertainment industry. You know, this is an industry that is uniformly, I wouldn't say reviled, that's too strong a word, but basically this is something that most of us spend our times trying to avoid. Nobody really seeks out advertising unless those advertisers are using the same techniques as entertainers or journalists and masquerading as such. And then if we know that they're advertising to us, then we change the way we think about it. So in the end, you know, it's sort of, how does one improve the world of advertising when really advertising is something we all try to avoid?
Well, but think about the Super Bowl. People watch the Super Bowl in order to watch the advertising. So imagine if the trade-off was, instead of you having to pay to watch HBO, I would tell you, we're going to present Game of Thrones and there's going to be a 3-minute advertising block in the middle. Some people are going to get up and walk away, but some people are going to sit and watch. And the reality is advertisers always knew there were a certain number of people who were going up to grab a beer or use the bathroom or walk the dog during those commercial breaks. But if the ads were good enough and they were put in such a way so that people weren't offended by them, but were almost asked to engage with them rather than being batted over the head with them, there is a possibility of having that as a more acceptable model. And then because you limit the number of commercials, the television networks would be able to charge more money for them. Hmm. It also puts an infinite the onus onto the advertisers to create really good advertising instead of a lot of really bad advertising. Hmm.
And you don't mean necessarily the covert stuff like product placement. You mean things that are clearly identified as advertising, because that's just, you know, more ethical.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and if it's good, I mean, it's football. Some of the Super Bowl ads are really entertaining ads. If you take the time to really produce really good advertising, people will watch it.
I will have to wait until the next Super Bowl to find out. I've never actually watched either the Super Bowl or the ads. Mara, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Good luck with your book.
Thank you so much.
My guest is Mara Einstein, a professor of media studies at Queens College at the City University of New York. We've been talking about her new book, Black Ops Advertising, Native Ads, Content Marketing, and the Covert World of the Digital Cell. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com and on Twitter at twitter.com/RUWithSonali.